Okay, well, I want to thank everybody for coming out today and for your interest in how the criminal justice system impacts victims, and more importantly, how victims can better be served by the criminal justice system. As Dan said in the introduction, I'm a psychologist in private practice in Hamilton, Ontario, and I work with many individuals who have lost a loved one through homicide. I'm also the mother of a homicide victim. My 2.5-year-old son, Zachary, was stabbed by my neighbor, who suffered from a serious mental illness and was subsequently deemed not criminally responsible. My journey since Zachary's death has been a long one, characterized initially by a quiet period of healing, and more recently by public activity and advocacy. Last year, as Dan said, I came forward to speak out against Bill C-54, the Not Criminally Responsible Reform Act. This led me to be more public in my fight against stigma for those who suffer from mental illness, and also in my advocacy for improved mental health services. I also began to consider and to really think about how victims can best be served in the criminal justice system. I began to reflect not necessarily on victims' rights, but more importantly, on the needs of victims. I would argue that this is something that the current government neglects in their tough-on-crime approach. In my work with victims, reflecting on their experience, and also reflecting on my own personal experience, I have come to believe that victims' rights, as they are currently proposed by the government, may not always be consistent with what victims need. In my practice, I work with individuals who have suffered a significant loss. I work with bereaved parents who have experienced the sudden and tragic death of their children, either through car accidents, through suicide, or through homicide. I also work with other family members of homicide victims, siblings, spouses, and children. And in my work with individuals who have lost a family member to a sudden and tragic death, I pay close attention to what I feel helps these individuals. And I try to pay close attention to what helps individuals of homicide grief versus those of more normal grief, if you will, because there are differences between normal grief and homicide grief. And I also try to pay attention to what hinders their recovery towards healing after the death of their loved one. Not only do victims of homicide have to navigate the tough journey through the traumatic grief experience, they also have to navigate through the criminal justice system. And this is a world full of systems that they do not know, and it's full of many people they do not know, and perhaps more importantly, who don't know their loved one who has died. And as you can imagine, at the worst time in their lives, it's very overwhelming. And sometimes, in the adversarial system that's before them, it can also be more complicated. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be allowed into the private lives of my clients and to bear witness to the intensity of their emotional pain. And it's my hope that in some way I can help them not only survive, but learn to live again. It's my hope that as they're thrown into the criminal justice system, that I can foster in them a hope that they can survive and learn to live again. The criminal justice system is a system which many voice, they feel that in they don't matter, so they don't matter in the criminal justice system. That's an area where they're not really the focus. And I want them in my practice to know that there are people who care about them, that they are my focus, and that we focus on their loved one as well. We focus on their healing and their recovery and their justice. And I can say that the demonstration of empathy to a homicide survivor goes a long way in the healing process, knowing that you care and that they are your focus. And even for those individuals who are more on the angry side and whose anger is likely further fueled by the criminal justice system, I have learned that once you develop a therapeutic relationship and trust, you can pull them out a little bit of that adversarial system and work with them to try to use their energy to focus on coping and, in time, healing. They have to come to learn that, sadly, they cannot change what happened to them, nor can they change or will they likely have much impact on the criminal justice system. As I said at the outset, my journey has been a long one, and not one that I ever imagined when I entered the field of psychology some 20 years ago. Today, I hope to give you a glimpse into that journey, into my own personal experience, and also into my work with individuals who have lost a loved one to homicide. And as I walk you through this journey and share my experience and the experience of my clients, I hope to help you understand what victims may need. Before turning to my own personal experience, I just want to say that as I reflect on my work, the one fact that stands out for me is that among all the individuals I serve, those impacted by the traumatic death of their loved one are among the most vulnerable and the most sensitive I work with. They need much care, much support, and much understanding. Individuals impacted by the traumatic death of their loved one not only have grief, but they also have trauma. And the trauma, by its very nature, impacts their grief, often prolonging it and complicating it. And there are other factors which can impact their grief as well, the criminal justice system being one of them. Individuals impacted by homicide typically have both trauma work to do and grief work to do. And the criminal justice system can actually negatively impact both aspects of treatment. Let me take you back to March 27th, 1997. March 27th, 1997 was a beautiful spring day. Holy Thursday, actually. I had recently completed my PhD and was heading out that morning to a job I loved to drop my beautiful boy off to a babysitter he loved. I clearly recall walking across the street that morning with Zachary's little hand in mine that life was good. Actually, that day, I reflected that life actually felt perfect. I dropped Zachary off and went to my office, and just after my noontime client, I walked out of my office to be greeted by a police officer. Of course, I didn't think he was there for me, but then he said there had been an accident. He told me that Zachary was at the hospital and he would take me to the hospital. He reassured me it mustn't be bad, otherwise little Zachary would be at McMaster. I thought, oh yes, Zachary had probably fallen off the climber and broken his arm, and the babysitter probably needed me to go and relieve her. The police officer took me by myself in his cruiser to the hospital. But still, my mind never went to bad news. We arrived in the emergency room at St. Joseph's, and there was chaos. There was a look of shock and horror on the faces of the people as I walked in. I can clearly recall the look of one police officer as I approached the door and the look of horror on his face. But I did not know still at this time that the chaos before me and the look of horror on these faces were because my beautiful Zachary had been stabbed and killed by my neighbor who suffered a serious mental illness. I was taken, still alone, into a small room, and the doctor informed me he did not make it. I didn't know what he was talking about. It could not be, I said. He told me that he had been stabbed. I said, that cannot be. He was only 2 and a half. I screamed for what seemed to be an eternity, and then I began to ask questions. Who? How? What? And then I said, it was the neighbor. The doctor then left, as these questions were not questions he could answer. After all, it was now a homicide case, an investigation, and my beautiful Zachary was referred to as the victim, the deceased. I was still alone in a room full of people I did not know and who did not know my Zachary. And little did I know that all too soon I would be thrown into the criminal justice system, a system full of many little systems and many people I did not know, a system which at times was cold and always impossible to navigate. I had no roadmap to guide me, and as a result, it would have been very easy to get lost. At the worst time in my life, traumatized by the sudden and tragic death of my beautiful boy, I was forced to have contact with these many different people, all who had a different job to do. Sadly, yet also understandably, my trauma and my grief were not an immediate concern for many of the people I came in contact with. They wanted facts, and they had questions. They had work to do, and their work focused on the crime and on the accused. And many times, there was an adversarial air to what they were doing. They were gathering evidence and going after first-degree murder. I felt alone and greatly troubled by this headstrong focus on the facts, their case, their evidence. What about my beautiful boy who had been robbed of his life? What about my trauma and my grief, which would impact my life forever? Few seemed to focus on my experience, on my trauma, my grief, or Zachary. All this focus on the facts, despite research evidence that support at the time of the trauma is critical in the treatment of trauma and central to the needs of grief and mourning. Now, I say that few focused on my needs because there was one person in that small hospital room and among all the systems involved for whom I was the sole focus. I was the sole focus of the victim service worker. She was there for me, and I could sense that. She was the strength that I did not have. She did the work my mind could not do. She respected me and my pain and my beautiful boy. And I now know that without the victim service worker and the respect that she afforded me, that the resilience I needed to weather the emotional earthquake that I had thrown into would not have been nurtured or fostered. Her initial presence was comforting and somehow calming. It served to decrease that sense of loneliness that I felt. With her presence, I felt safe. She had knowledge of my experience, of my grief and my trauma, and she talked to me about beautiful Zachary, and she also had knowledge of the systems before me. In the short time her services were available to me, she provided me with invaluable assistance and a foundation from which I could go forward. And although victim service workers are often there only at the time of the crime or for a short few days after, which is something I would fight to change, she broke the rules, if you will, and I knew that whenever I needed her, she would be there. And she was. She was there the moment I learned of Zachary's death, and she was also there as we began preparation for the trial and later at the time of the inquest. She also put me in contact with a bereavement counselor. She made sure that we met, and she followed up to make sure that we had connected. She, or Brenda, did her job as it should be done. Sadly, as I will discuss later, not all victims, even today, get this service. Brenda was compassionate, and she focused on me. She provided support, and she provided education regarding what might lie ahead. She never fueled false expectations, but was honest in relaying what I might expect from the systems before me. She was honest in suggesting that whatever the outcome of the pending trial, it would not take away my pain, my hurt, or change what had happened. She gently guided me, she gently guided my direction from the outset towards healing, and she focused on my needs. After the traumatic death of Zachary, and not long after he was buried, the criminal investigation was underway. For me, I was fortunate, given the victim service worker, as I already noted, broke some of the rules and stayed by my side. She informed me of what was going on, and she was my voice, given that I was not functioning very well at times. When we were to meet with the Crown, she said that she wanted to be present. They said no. She insisted, and she was persistent, and she was there. Her presence was critical, not only for the information given, which often I didn't understand or couldn't remember, because your mind doesn't work well when your heart is broken, but I also knew that I was her focus. As much as the Crown focused on the case and the charge of first-degree murder, Brenda focused on me, ensuring that I was not re-victimized and empowering me when possible. And like I said, she quickly connected me with my bereavement counselor, one who, I might add, did not worry about funding, who was willing to assist pro bono if needed. She, another Brenda, was my second lifeline. Initially, I saw her twice a week, sometimes for two-hour sessions, but she was there for me to provide ongoing treatment as I needed. She provided support during the trial, support during the pregnancy of my second son, and support during the inquest. Such ongoing support with the same few people is critical as the investigation begins, because the criminal investigation brings up traumatic memories that the traumatized brain tries very hard to avoid. And as a result, ongoing treatment is necessary. And as I will come back later, still some 16 years later, such services are not always available, and they aren't easy to access. The courtroom experience in and of itself is an experience that no one can be prepared for. And the impact it has on victims is not one that you could even begin to imagine. Even what might seem like the smallest detail in the minds of others is huge in the minds of victims in the aftermath of the murder of their loved ones. As a victim, I didn't know what to expect, and there were many things that surprised me. And sadly, when I work with my clients, this still happens some 16 years later. Although I'm not an angry person, some of these experiences did make me angry. Not necessarily because they focused more on the accused than me, but they didn't seem to focus at all on my beautiful boy who had been robbed of his life. Well, they focused on the crime and how best to deal with the accused, but they seemed to have little sense of the wider impact of this act. Let me give you a little insight into some of the courtroom experiences so you can better understand what I am referring to. Understandably, I thought, I feared seeing the accused after the homicide, given I hadn't seen her for some time before the murder. Surprisingly, many people I came in contact with, except for my victim service worker or my bereavement counselor, were oblivious to my anxiety. In fact, some thought I might look forward to seeing her. Their lack of awareness and consideration of my feelings made me feel like they didn't appreciate my experience or validate the intensity of my pain. And this, like I said, is still voiced by many of my clients today. Victims are not in an emotional place nor a cognitive place to even begin to consider that others in the courtroom do have a job to do. As the proceedings began, I was shocked when at times my son was not even referred to by name, but instead the victim. This felt very wrong and very dehumanizing. After all, in my mind, wasn't this about my boy? Quickly, though, given the honesty and support of my workers, I came to learn that the courtroom experience and the prosecution was about the accused and her state of mind, not really about Zachary, who had lost his life. And then I heard the Crown call the defense lawyer my friend. Well, this seems strange to me and so inconsistent with what was going on in my mind. The friend of the Crown, I wasn't sure, really, was a friend of mine. From the outset, in discussions behind closed doors with the Crown, there was more of a us against them feeling. But then when we came out behind closed doors, the Crown was calling the defense counsel his friend. I know it may seem small or petty when voiced now, but when your beautiful child has just been murdered, such events stand out, and they hurt. I also recall how it impacted me when in the courtroom, people were going about planning their days, planning Thanksgiving, planning their weekends. And I recall thinking how insensitive of them. I just wanted to scream and ask them, "Do you not know why we are here? My son has been killed." Thankfully for me, I was surrounded by people both inside and outside of the system for whom I was the focus, and thankfully who could explain these behaviors to me and who reassured me that these people had jobs to do. Many of my clients continue to voice upset that they are instructed in the courtroom not to demonstrate any emotion. This is very difficult for them. They find it hurtful and they find it disrespectful of their pain and grief and their loved one. The support that I had softened this apparent neglect of others. I now know that this perceived neglect was not intentional. These people, during the prosecution in the courtroom, they had jobs to do, and they meant no ill intent to me. They were working in their system, and their focus was on the crime, the accused, and how best to manage that side of the case. Their focus on the offender didn't mean that they did not care about me. Nevertheless, when I reflect on my experience and also the experience of my clients, it highlights that victims need education and they need support available to them at every step along the way. They need it consistently and they need not worry whether it will be funded or not. And I might suggest if the system was somewhat less adversarial, it might be more manageable for all involved. In addition to support I was provided within the system, such as my victim service worker and my bereavement counselor, I also had friends, thankfully, who were lawyers. A friend of mine, a lawyer, looked out for me. She came to the trial. She provided me with emotional support, and she also provided me with practical support and information about what was going on. She also put me in contact with a criminal lawyer, who, to my surprise, is here today, Mr. Jeffrey Manishin, and he worked hard with me and endlessly to help me understand the definition of not criminally responsible. It was a definition I just could not get. Likely because my mind was clouded by the fact that my son had just been murdered. But Jeff worked with me and he went over and over that definition until I got it. Then, after the NCR accused had been assessed, the forensic psychiatrist who did the assessment met with us. He again explained the definition of NCR, or not criminally responsible, and the mental state of the woman who had killed my son. And in his interaction, he was informative, but more importantly, he was respectful. He was respectful of what had happened to me, to my pain and my loss. He was very empathetic, and like I said, that goes a long way. Given the criminal justice system was tough on me for many reasons, tough to navigate and also difficult emotionally, and given that some of the experiences I had during that time had a lasting negative impact on me, in my work with victims, I try to prepare them for this experience within the criminal justice system. And more importantly, I try to ensure that they know that I am there for them, to support them, to focus on them and their needs, and on their loved one who has been killed. Given most victims feel that their loved one is very neglected within the criminal justice system. Currently, I, and I would have to say most of my clients, would argue that the criminal justice system, as it currently operates, is not about victims. And a large number of clients would say that it doesn't serve them well. And some would say that it doesn't serve them at all. It perplexes me to hear such statements in the long-standing efforts on the part of the governments to ensure victims' rights. Victims' rights have been talked about for many years now, and yet I see every day that many victims still do not feel attended to, they do not feel supported, and they do not feel as if they matter. I think this may relate to the fact that the government is not listening and not considering what victims need to heal and recover. The government's approach seems to focus on an increased involvement in the criminal justice system, which currently is very adversarial, but it also can be, by its very nature, traumatizing and re-victimizing. So I have been asking, are the proposed victims' rights actually consistent with the needs of victims? Is the criminal justice system really the best place for victims? Is it a place where they can have their needs attended to? In trying to consider victims and the criminal justice system, I began to ask, what is the role of this system overall? What is the goal of this system? It seeks to serve justice. Justice for who? For the accused? For the victim? For society? What is the role for and of the victim in the current system? How can victims of crime best be served? I would say that victims can be better treated than they currently are, and that there are other options that many victims are open to and that are less adversarial and might serve them better in their healing. Victims need to be heard, but perhaps in the courtroom is not the best place. They need to be heard and listened to so that they can have their needs addressed. Contrary to what the current government might think, and consistent with the literature, not all victims are fueled by vengeance. When Dan asked me to speak, I started to ask many of my clients, what has been helpful to you, and what do you think you need? It's a small sample, but I'm going to share some of the responses with you. Many focus on their needs. They don't focus on the accused or on vengeance. And I think that if we could tend to the needs of victims, they might be less angry. And I believe that much of the anger we see is fueled by the lack of respect or understanding of the victim's experience and their needs within the current system. One victim clearly stated the point to me, and she said, and quote, "The system made me angry." She was wise in noting that somehow she had to deal with the murder of her son, and she had to learn to cope. She stated, quote, "But the system got in the way of that." She was angered by the experience, and she stated, "The accused's life has been bettered. He had access to good food, to a gym, and to education." She wondered who helped better her life. She had to fight for her treatment. Every time we used up the 12 sessions they allowed and we had to write another letter, her anxiety increased that maybe she wouldn't have access to treatment. Her traumatic grief also impacted her physical health, so a gym membership would have been nice. And she couldn't return to work as a personal support worker to watch people dying, given she came upon her son who had been stabbed to death. But there was nobody to help her rebuild her life. She also wished that the accused would have to write a letter acknowledging what he did. She summed up her experience stating that as victims, we need assistance to, quote, "help us help ourselves." Another client described the investigation by police as quite swampy, leaving her to discover too much, including the bloody clothes of her son who was killed. She voiced that there was no education, still, despite victims' rights, that she was left in the dark, that she had no how-tos. She wished the Crown had been more accessible, and she also wished for more regular contact with the victim witness program. She had asked me, "Dr. Lori, would you come to the preliminary hearing with me?" And I said, "Sure." Then she came to the next session and said, "You don't have to come. The victim witness worker will be coming with me." So I said, "Okay." She came back the next session and I said, "How did it go?" She said, "The victim witness worker came, said she had to go to Toronto, and left me all alone." This was a young girl with no family support, whose young child had been murdered, and she was afraid to face the accused. I think her point highlights that what's in place is not working. And it also highlights to me, sadly, as I see in my practice, that not all victims are treated alike. Many people also voice frustration with delays in the system. Many will say it's because the defense counsel is requesting this delay. They said that it seems so unfair. My one client now has to wait several years for the trial. She's looking at, I think, 2015, said she just wants to get this done. She wants to get through the court proceedings so that she can begin to try to heal and rebuild her life. Victims do need to rebuild, given their lives have been completely shattered, often rendering them unable to function. I didn't work for a year after Zachary's death, and I had assistance in rebuilding. But like I said, many victims don't get this. As I said at the outset, victims impacted by a violent crime have trauma work to do, as well as grief work. And treatment efforts are hindered by the criminal justice system. Trauma work, for example, involves processing traumatic memories in a safe and therapeutic environment. The criminal justice system, which focuses on the crime and the investigation, exposes the victim's traumatic memories over and over again in a non-therapeutic environment, risking re-traumatization. So they need continued treatment throughout if they must be in that system. Maybe their involvement in that system can be minimized instead of increased. This might serve victims better. In addition to traumatic memories, anger is not uncommon, both to grief and both to post-traumatic stress. Such anger needs to be processed, again, in a therapeutic environment so that the individual can learn to manage their anger and begin to reconcile with what has happened to them. But their anger is fueled by the adversarial criminal justice system, which focuses on the crime and the death of their loved one. It doesn't focus on the life memories. It doesn't focus on honoring and remembering the individual who has died, which is important to the tasks of grief and mourning. Intense involvement in the criminal justice system delays the ability of victims to do their work in rebuilding. I would argue that justice for victims cannot be tied into nor dependent upon how the offender is dealt with. When offenders are brought to the bar of justice, the judge must act in a just way toward the offender. The offender will be accountable for his action in a way that the system feels just. Victims, too, also need to be dealt with in a just manner. And I would argue that justice for victims is assistance in helping them recover and rebuild from the harm they have suffered. The death of a loved one by homicide has wide and far-reaching effects, including the immeasurable emotional costs that I've already said require therapeutic attention, the financial cost, not only in terms of cost of funeral, but also lost wages, or for some, like I've said, an inability to return to work for some time. Their traumatic grief also impacts their physical health, and that needs attention too. Victims need to feel that society, that the government, recognizes that what has happened to them is wrong and that there is a system in place that will help them. In the vision of so-called parallel justice, a framework proposed by Susan Herman in the United States, offenders are held accountable for the harms they've caused, and there is a belief that a separate obligation exists to repair the harm caused by the crime to the victim. They argue that this is the right of the victim. The notion that the rights of victims of crime is to have their needs attended to will change the way that people might think or talk when they think about what is best or most appropriate for victims. Yes, sometimes victims do need to be in the criminal justice system, and when they are, we need to ensure that they are respected and heard and that they have information and understanding. But they also need to be heard outside of the courtroom. And the pursuit of justice for victims needs to be separate from the administration of justice for the offenders. They need a different system, if you will, one that tends to their need for safety, and their need to rebuild. And I am not sure that the Federal Victims Bill of Rights will actually secure justice for victims in their need to heal. Last year, victims' rights were coupled in the news with Bill C-54, the Not Criminally Responsible Reform Act. The media coverage of this bill upset me and angered me. I felt it was misleading to victims and also to Canadians. On March 27, 2013, I was off work that day, given that since Zachary's death, I continued to take that day off, mainly for the purpose of self-care. And it was on that day that a verdict of not criminally responsible was reached in a high-profile tragic case in Ontario when an OPP officer was run over by a man driving a snowplow. It was determined by a jury that the man driving the snowplow suffered a serious mental illness, and owing to the nature of his illness, he engaged in a behavior that led to the death of another human being. The media coverage that followed this event also drew attention to other high-profile cases, such as the tragic event out west when a young man was beheaded on a Greyhound bus, again by an individual found not criminally responsible. The media coverage, like I said, on Bill C-54 stirred feelings in me that were quite strong. And given the intensity of these feelings, I felt that I needed to explore them further. Bill C-54, now C-14, stirred in me feelings of upset because it was and remains very stigmatizing and punitive, and it doesn't reflect an accurate understanding of serious mental illness. In addition, it makes false claims of public safety. And in doing so, I believe it misleads Canadians and, more importantly, victims. To see Mr. Harper introduce Bill C-54 at a podium with a sign in front that read, "Supporting Victims," angered me. He clearly is misleading Canadians and creating false expectations in victims. Locking away an NCR accused and throwing away the key for 3 years is not only punitive and stigmatizing, but it fuels vengeance and false hope that somehow this will help the victim heal. Mr. Harper somehow equates tough on crime with support for victims. And as we know, the tough on crime approach doesn't work. Further, in my work with victims, and as the research suggests, victims are not driven by, nor more importantly, healed by, vengeance. In fact, I would suggest that approach that draws them into focusing on punishing the accused may actually hinder their recovery. They need instead to focus on themselves, their trauma, their grief, their loved one, and their need to rebuild. Anger is a normal reaction, as I've said, to grief and to trauma, and it needs to be addressed in treatment, not fueled by a criminal justice system. Such anger will eat victims up, and sadly, in the end, it won't impact anyone but themselves in a harmful way. Drawing victims in as adversaries will focus on the crime and the death of their loved one, not assist them in their treatment and in the work of mourning, where they can focus on their loved one and come to honor and remember their loved one. And in the end, after the sentencing, whether people are happy or unhappy with the sentence, the victim is still left without their loved one to rebuild their lives. And this is what the government seems to neglect. The end of the trial and the sentencing of the offender does not bring closure to the victim. There is no such thing as closure when your loved one has been killed by homicide. What the end of the trial actually does is put an end to the process that slowed or interfered with their healing. In the criminal justice system, there are two parties involved, the accused and the victim. And whether the government or anyone else for that matter likes it or not, the way the criminal justice system has been designed to work, or at least my understanding of how it currently works, is to be just in its dealing with offenders. And as I already stated, the judge is required to be just when dealing with offenders. As many of us know, offenders are often victims themselves, many with mental health issues. Research suggests that 80% are sad and 20% are bad. In putting forward their arguments for a need for a federal victims' bill of rights, the government suggests that victims have been abandoned for far too long. And they talk about victims being the missing piece. They suggest, falsely, I would say, that in order to balance justice, victims require more participation in the process. So they offer to pull victims into the criminal justice system, a system which focuses on the accused and how to manage the accused, which has the potential, as I've already said, to re-traumatize and re-victimize the victim. It fuels anger in them, and it creates false expectation, somehow suggesting that if we're tough on crime, we better serve victims. Tough on crime does not equate with helping victims. Victims, as I've said, need to heal. No sentence will ever be just, in quotes, just enough. No sentence will ever bring their loved one back. But a focus on their needs, their emotional needs, their financial needs, their physical needs will go a long way in helping them heal. Actually, as I reflected on my thoughts when I was putting them together for today, I thought that I might go as far as to argue that from a psychological perspective, a tough-on-crime approach can actually be tough on victims, given it draws them in to this adversarial system focused on punishing the accused, directing their efforts towards punishment and vengeance, rather than using the very little energy they have to focus on taking care of themselves. I was treated very well in my experience as a victim. I was treated with respect, and I believe I was treated justly. And this, I believe, relates largely to the fact that I had people both in and out of the system who focused on me, who focused on my needs and my healing, and who actually directed my attention away from involvement in the criminal justice system. Not all victims that I work with have the support that I did. And like I said, sadly, not all victims are treated equally. For the most part, I had access to what I needed, when I needed it, offered often to me pro bono. Sadly, I bear witness to the fact that what is in place today to help victims, and I do know there are some excellent services in place, but they're not always offered to all victims. They're not always working, as I've said, and they're not always easily accessible. And even more sadly, this appears to be the case for those with the least support, for those with the least education, and those with the less money. In order to serve all victims justly, this must change. I believe that victims need access to service from well-trained people to assist them from the moment they learn of the crime and onward, even beyond the crime. I had support, like I said, through the birth of my second child and then through the inquest. Those who work with victims must be careful not to be tempted by anger, and they must be aware of and offer options to victims. Throwing them into the criminal justice system does not always serve victims well. I never attended one review board hearing, and this was likely because I was presented the option that I didn't have to go. I think more importantly, I was given permission by my bereavement counselor that because I didn't go, didn't mean that I forgot or that I loved Zachary less. Instead, she reminded me that I needed every ounce of energy I had to focus on my recovery and on honoring Zachary. Some victims I know do feel that they must attend courtroom appearances or parole hearings. And although in my work, I gently sometimes suggest to them that maybe they don't need to go, when they come back and tell me, "Lori, I've thought about it, and for my son, I need to go." But they go knowing that it's for their son and with no false expectation that they're going to have any impact on the system. Victims currently have to fight for the services that they get. Many I work with fear that they won't be granted additional funding for treatment. This is very unsettling. It heightens their anxiety, which is already pretty high. And frankly, it's unacceptable. Like I said, victims might also require compensation for loss of income. The death of your loved one shakes you to the very core, and the task of living each day, never mind thinking of work, is difficult for quite some time. When I finally returned to work, I did so gradually, and I did so with support. Not all victims have this opportunity. Victims need to be heard. They need a forum, not within the criminal justice system, where they can be heard. And more importantly, they need to be listened to. They need to be able to talk about the impact of the crime on them, not for the purpose of sentencing, but as it relates to their needs to heal and recover. Such opportunities might take place, for example, and when appropriate, in different restorative justice programs. Victims need options, they need legal protection, they need to feel safe, they need to feel supported and heard, they need assistance, which, like I've said, can take many forms. Victims have high needs. And as I have argued today, I think it is victims' rights to have their needs attended to, for this would only seem just. Thank you.